stereotypes are oftentimes uttered as justification for denying Hindus their basic human rights.
We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
Here I am.
Here I am.
And here I am with Shai Davidai.
My guest today has the following for her Twitter bio. Not left, not right, seeker, open mind, Hindu lens, Garba freak, mom of two, executive director of Hindu American Foundation. Here I am with Suhag Shukla.
Great to be here.
Suhag, before we start everything, I need to ask, what is a Garba freak?
A Garba freak. So Garba is a dance from my area of, or rather where my parents came from in India, which is Western India. And we have a festival that's dedicated to the feminine divine. And so it happens four times a year, but there's one in particular in the fall where everyone gathers and we dance in a circle. And it's just, it's like meditation and movement. And it's something that just deeply connects me with my heritage, with my ancestors, and I love to dance. And I even started a team in college at the University of Florida in 1993, where now young people even gather for competitions. And so it's just something that pulsates within me. So,
what kind of a dance? If I close my eyes just so I can imagine it, what does it look like?
So everyone is moving in a circle, and there's claps and snaps, and it's like one simple basic like front, turn to the back, move backwards, turn to the front, but then there's variations with turns. But there's something about when everyone is doing very similar movements, the basic movements are the same, but everyone has their own little style or embellishment to it, and it's all to like the pulsating of one drum. And a lot of the songs are like singing the praises of the feminine divine. Powers like fierceness, but also being compassionate at the same time. So all of those things are like values and qualities that I think we need to bring more of into the world. And they are kind of encapsulated in our stories of the feminine divine.
All right. So we'll get to those values and qualities. And before we start, or as we start, I want to ask you, Suhag Shukla, what are you fighting for?
Oh, wow. I'm fighting for so many things these days. Truth, and I said that sounds a little bit hokey maybe, but finding ways to, I think, you know, truth is not like there's one truth necessarily, but I feel like there's not honesty in conversation anymore. People are really scared to share their opinions on important issues, whether it's how we navigate coexistence in a pluralistic democracy, how we handle law and order. All of these pressing issues, I think people are guarded because there's a kind of cancel culture, essentially, on both sides that prohibit people from feeling safe in sharing their opinions. And if we don't share honestly what our concerns are, what we think possible solutions are, we're really not solving anything. Mm.
Why is there such a need to fight for the truth? Seems like the truth is, first of all, self-evident. Second, you know, doesn't need us humans to fight for it. Why is it such an important thing?
Well, I think we see it right now. Just the uneasiness. I know I'm constantly feeling uneasy that the ground that we stand on, things that we could kind of rely on, that, you know, every human has an inherent value. And it doesn't matter what they look like. It doesn't matter who they love. It doesn't matter what color their skin is, but they all have value, and that we can build a society where that value is respected, it's celebrated, even our differences are celebrated. But it just feels uneasy right now that we can't even have that conversation, even though we live in a country that was built on a promise of that. Not a promise that's always been fulfilled, but one that was. And today it just seems like we've had injustices in the past, and the solutions to those injustices is just flipping the script. So now whoever suffered before, they should no longer suffer, but those who were behind the suffering, whatever they represent. And again, it's all based on these outward differences that now they need to suffer. And no one's really looking to human flourishing. And I think truth in that sense is required for human flourishing.
I agree. I completely agree. I think, you know, this is why the tattoo I got after October 7 was Emet, truth. Mm-hmm. You know, it's for me, it's been the same kind of fight from probably a different lens, but mm-hmm. the same fight. So you were born and raised in San Francisco, went to law school. What kind of law did you practice?
So I've always been a bleeding heart. My first job, I remember I went to my immigrant Indian father. First of all, I have a bachelor's in religion. Even pursuing that for an immigrant parent was like, wait a minute, what are you doing? You have to go to college so that you are employable afterwards.
And religion doesn't employ a lot of people.
Religion, he did not see as something that could get me a job. Certainly, he's like, what's your backup plan? What if you don't make it into law school? Because I always wanted to go to law school. So I got an economics degree as well to placate him, although I was somewhat interested in economics. And then I went to law school knowing full well that I wanted to help people. I didn't know exactly what that looked like. But my first job out of law school was being a homeless advocate. So I worked, I had a grant where I went from soup kitchens to domestic violence shelters, helping people with public benefits and that sort of thing. So that was, I was always driven towards kind of helping the underdog, so to speak. And then later, as I started a family, kind of the travel that was required for my position just wasn't conducive to what I also wanted to do with my family. And so I switched over to immigration. And did immigration for a couple of years. And that was right around the time that we started the Hindu American Foundation. And before I knew it, the work of the foundation, the needs had grown so much that I found myself walking away from my paid job to kind of follow my passion, which is the work that we do at HAF.
Right. And I want to get exactly to what you do and what are the needs and the problems that you're fulfilling. But one of the themes of this podcast is regular people doing irregular stuff, mm-hmm. you know, normal people doing amazing stuff. And not just to applaud and celebrate you, but also to show people that everyone can do it.
Yeah.
So we're going to get to what your passion is, but how did you make the transition from being a, you know, relatively high-profile lawyer, you know, San Francisco, working all the time, to all of a sudden becoming a co-founder of this organization?
Yeah, you know, I think youth was something that probably helped in that you're not thinking about, at least I wasn't. I didn't have profile. I didn't have necessarily anything outlined. I just was kind of in this space where there's a problem. It needs someone to be working on it. I had other people that I was in touch with that had that same desire. And I think maybe because we were also all raised in Hindu households, and one of the core philosophies is that you work selflessly. You don't work necessarily towards for the fruit of your labor, but you just work for the sake of working. And I think I grew up with that. You know, my parents were immigrants. They came to this country with very little, close to nothing, and built a life for all of us. So I think it was just kind of our value system in that sense. It's also a pre-internet age, right, where like the famous people were like really famous people. They were in the newspapers, and you didn't have that sort of access to build a profile in that sense. So you just kind of focused on, well, what can I do? And
well, let me push back on that, because one, yes, you saw a need, but you could have easily said, okay, here's a problem. Why aren't other people doing it? Why focus on what can I do? And the second is, there are even a lot of Hindu Americans. Mm-hmm. You know, there's about just over 3 million.
Yeah.
Hindu Americans, like, there's a lot of people who could do what you did.
Yeah.
And a lot of people listening is like, what is she doing? And we'll get to that.
I think maybe it's because we thought we could do something about it, right? We grew up with this appreciation for what our parents' generation did. And that is something that I shared with my co-founders. We appreciated the institutions they built or the home environment that they cultivated that made us appreciate our culture, our heritage, our teachings, our values. And we also were very acutely aware, having been schooled through the American public school system, being exposed to American pop culture, that what we knew ourselves to be, there was a complete disconnect with what the American public at large saw us to be. But we walked and talked like Americans. I mean, you know, we grew up watching the Brady Bunch and wanting to go hang out at the mall and all of those things. So we were always navigating two worlds, so to speak, our inner world and then the external world. So, you know, maybe different from other generations, we felt like we could kind of walk the walk and talk the talk and, you know, just the idealism of youth to say, well, why can't we do something about this? And
so what did you do?
That's what it was.
Let's get to it.
What did I do?
You co-founded the Hindu American Foundation.
Yes.
AJF.
HAF, and it's the first advocacy organization that was kind of created in mind to have a professional staff that would full-time focus on the needs of the community in two realms, education and advocacy. And so I met like-minded people, one of them being my husband, but another being an ER physician in California named Dr. Mihir Meghani, and a classmate of mine from law school, Nikhil Joshi. And we all in different spheres were having conversations about our narrative. What is our story and how is it being told? What we did know is that we were not telling it. And so how are we going to be able to tell our story, whether it's through what Americans at large learn about Hinduism and ancient India and even modern India through K-12 education, whether it's how the media presents us, whether it's how policymakers are, you know, legislating in ways that either hurt our community, which has been more recently something that we've been dealing with, or help our community. And all of those things, we were looking to communities like the Jewish community to see, well, how have they seen success? And it was through professionalizing their needs, getting people who had the pedigree, the educational skills, the know-how to be able to walk into a space where you need to change minds to dedicate their full-time effort to these things. And so,
but what is the problem that's being addressed? What are the minds that are being, and, you know, treat me like a 5-year-old, but my 4-year-old is brilliant. So treat me as a tabula rasa.
Yeah.
Someone who really doesn't understand, like, you're solving a problem, but what
right.
is the problem?
Well, the problem is that much of what the Western world knows about India and Hinduism is still through a colonial framework. And so the way in which the West began studying Hinduism came with an ulterior motive. It was to colonize, and down the line, once it went beyond just the capitalistic impulse, it also became a missionary impulse. How do you paint an entire civilization in a manner that justifies colonization and justifies missionizing? So you can imagine that we can basically look at all of the stereotypes that we deal with today as Hindus, that, you know, Hinduism can only be reduced down to a caste system where we have a group of oppressors and oppressed and we oppress one another, that it is a cacophony of all these gods and there's no necessarily unifying foundational concepts that bring these diverse traditions together that have a articulated vision of what the divine is, that women are inferior to men and it's a patriarchal religious tradition, and also a lot of conflation with the socioeconomic realities and the political realities of India being mapped onto the religion. So we have a whole slew of stereotypes that are completely disconnected with what Hindu life actually is about. And so that lends to stereotypes, which then lends to bias and discrimination and also human rights atrocities, not in a place like the United States, but you go to places like Pakistan and Bangladesh, and many of these stereotypes are oftentimes uttered as justification for denying Hindus their basic human rights.
Was there a moment in time, maybe as a kid, maybe in law school, I don't know exactly when it was, where you had that clarity to say, hey, wait a minute, someone else is telling my story and it's not in an accurate fashion?
Yeah, I remember the exact day. And it was ninth grade world history. And I'm at Monta Vista High School in the San Francisco Bay Area. And back then, my high school now is probably like 50 or 60% Asian, a large chunk of which are people of Indian origin, many of whom are Hindu. And so I was the only Indian origin Hindu in that classroom of 30. And we learned about so many of these stereotypes that I just outlined. So my teacher, Mrs. Green, had me stand up and she asked me three questions. Suhag, what caste are you? Suhag, have your parents arranged your marriage? I'm in ninth grade, so maybe 13 or 14. And are they saving up for your dowry?
So I assume the answer was no.
Yeah. Well, and funny enough, like one of the things that I think a lot of second generation Indian Americans and Hindu Americans was like the hot topic was, can we date or not? Right? Because we're coming from kind of a conservative culture where, dating was not something that was part of the culture. And so this was always like an argument, arranged marriage or date and, you know, love marriage. Like these were kind of the big topics that we would argue with our parents. So I knew the answer to the second one, that absolutely not.
But you're standing there in front of your class being asked these three questions. You were the only Hindu American in class. How did you feel?
I mean, other than wanting to climb under my desk, I felt voiceless because I didn't know the answers to her questions. And these were questions that she was presenting as being fundamental to being Hindu. So I knew I was Hindu. I grew up with a very devout grandmother who practiced our traditions very closely on a daily basis. She would tell us stories that are from our sources of knowledge that, you know, were kind of forming the foundation of our value system. And I knew my parents to be good people. And the way she's presenting this kind of story of this tradition that's oppressive to people on the basis of their birth, that's oppressive to people on the basis of their gender, it didn't speak to me. One, it was embarrassing, not only because she's presenting this very kind of ugly picture of my people, but second, because now I'm shamed because I don't know about my people in the way that she's framing my people. And I say she, but it was the textbooks, right? Yeah. And so she assigned it to me as homework. And so then I had to go home. I mean, the second two questions, clearly I knew. But what do you do as a 13 or 14-year-old? It's not where I'm going to be like, no and no. And especially coming from a culture, one, we're an immigrant community. And so my parents' kind of big thing was, you just focus, keep your head down and study. We are here to succeed. We're here to take advantage of what this country offers us. And so that means that you don't get sidetracked by these types of things. You shouldn't be offended by this. Like, just because she said that, did it change who you are? I mean, these were the kinds of conversations that I had
when your parents told you, like, basically they were telling you what a lot of Jewish parents tell their kids, you know, keep your head down. Mm-hmm. Don't make a fuss.
Yeah.
What was your internal reaction?
My internal reaction, I mean, I really didn't know, because I think at that age, you really just want to be accepted. You want a sense of belonging. And I think deep down, my hope was just that I wouldn't be asked again. and the class would move on. And that's kind of what happened. But the other thing was that my parents actually didn't know how to even answer that first question because it didn't inform our reality, you know. And so, like, certainly we have our family and clan-based or regional-based customs and things like that. But once they had left India, their and their, you know, villages or their towns, they were exposed to so many different kinds of people from India and so many different forms of Hinduism that they found ways to unify around something that transcended their regional identities. And so they didn't even know how to answer me. So even if she had asked me that next day, I don't know that I would have been able to answer her. And I was actually quite relieved that it didn't come up because, you know, however many months you are in school, the topic of Indian Hinduism is maybe a whopping 2 days. And so it was done and then over. But it stuck with me that I can still remember that moment. I can still feel like the flushing feeling, right, of that heat kind of coursing down and then your face feeling red. I can still envision all of that. And it stuck with me long enough that when the opportunity to start HAF, when we were starting to have these conversations, it was still just as vivid as it as if it had happened the day before.
But what happened those probably about decade and a half between that first moment of realization that I am Hindu and I'm not even sure what that means, but it's definitely not what people say it means, to the point 15, 20 years later where you're like, I'm going to start an organization to make sure that no one else feels this way.
Yeah. I think it started with knowing that my parents are good people, knowing that my community had good people that treated each other very kindly, that, you know, we're living good lives, that we're making sacrifices for one another, whether it's building community institutions, whether it's supporting their families, whether it's bringing over family from India and then making sure that they get their footing. Like, those are all the things that I saw. So I kind of already knew in my gut that there's something here. And that motivated me to ask a lot of questions of my parents. And I think it kind of freaked my parents out initially, because for them, when you grow up in a country where the religious traditions are kind of just, they're immersed in the culture, you don't have to ask questions because no one is asking you questions. No one's questioning you. So for them, they did it because it was tradition. They did it because their ancestors did it. And this is the way it's always been done. But once you leave that comfort zone of like transmission through osmosis, I'm asking questions. And I think my asking those questions, one, freaked my parents out. Like, okay, wait, we didn't have this in mind when we came to this country. Yes, we were leaving a lot. We were leaving comfort. We were leaving that sense of security. We don't want this lost in this equation, in our pursuit for a better life. And so they enrolled me right around that time. These kind of Sunday schools were emerging, Hindu Sunday schools. And so they reached out to a respected auntie in the community and said, what do we do? She has all these questions. We don't know how to answer her. And so they enrolled me in this. Mm-hmm. And that just like kickstarted a more formal learning of the tradition. And I had a really amazing teacher. I think she was in college at the time. So she knew.
But she seemed older and wiser.
She did. Recently, she was on a webinar where I was the featured speaker, which was just like a full circle moment, which was amazing because I shared this story of how this college age teacher was so inspiring to me because she was able to take these ancient precepts and show how they had relevance, how they had value, how they could bring meaning to my life now. So that started. And that started giving me a vocabulary. Then I went to college and I had enough interest to want to pursue a degree in religion. Well, now I'm seeing the academic biases. Where do K through 12 textbooks have their materials? Where do they get it from? Well, they get it from academia. Well, in academia, not only do you have like these colonial paradigms that have kind of just become the way in which people talk about or study the tradition, you also have Marxist lens. The overarching kind of approach towards the study of religion does come from that kind of atheistic lens, right? So now you have two different paradigms that are inherently anti-religion or anti-Hindu. And so I'm coming face to face with that.
You've, as you're saying this, it dawns on me something really incredible that yes, you have the colonial narrative and you have the anti-colonial narrative.
Yes.
And both narratives originate from the West. We are both colonial.
Yes.
In the sense that it's not the Hindu narrative.
Right.
When it comes to Jews, it's not the Jewish narrative. You got the colonial saying, here's our lens. And you got the anti-colonials that saying the same thing. Here's our lens.
Right.
But it's the same thing.
It's the same thing. And I mean, I haven't studied Marx in any deep sense at all. However, from what my basic understanding is, he didn't hold very positive views about Hindus or Jews. So it's not like it's some objective scientific lens. It too is motivated in a way of that is going to color the way in which either tradition is studied. And we now also see the iterations of both of that, those kind of movements in politics as well, right? So all of these kind of experiences were just building up. I also had some issues that I helped other students navigate on college campus where, and this will, I know, sound familiar. I was in law school by this
time.
Set
the stage. So if you can say like what year, what place.
So this is 1993 or 1994. Mm-hmm. And I'm in law school already. I'm in my first year of law school. And what we had done undergrad, you know, we're an immigrant community and a relatively recent immigrant community because it wasn't until the lifting of the Asian Exclusion Act that large numbers of people of Indian origin and Hindus were able to immigrate to this country in large numbers. So my father came in 63 or 64. So you don't have the infrastructure, you don't have the resources that other communities have to address questions of faith. So Baptists had the Baptist Student Center. The Jewish students had B'nai B'rith. The Methodists had whatever they wanted. The Muslim students, there was a masjid in town. Hindu students had nothing. We had the Indian Student Association. But the Indian Student Association was, even though they did all of the cultural holidays, Diwali, Holi, which are all Hindu holidays, they were secularized so that we couldn't necessarily bring the religious aspects of those traditions to fore because I think, and this is kind of a self-consciousness that Hindus have internalized from the time of the beginning of the nation state of India, where you are creating this country out of a ugly religion-based partition. And so the majority starts internalizing this, we need to hold ourselves back so that the minority feels comfortable. And so
to make it clear for our listeners, the majority in India, and this is where you're distinguishing, you keep saying Indian of Indian origin versus Hindu, and you call your organization Hindu American.
Right.
So the majority in India are Hindu.
Yes.
Hindu is more than a religion. It's a culture. It's an ethnicity. It's, for our Jewish listeners, would sound very familiar, right? It's a civilization. Who are the minorities?
The minorities are Muslims, Christians, and at the time of partition, there's also Jains, Buddhists, and Sikhs, but they, I think, were kind of seen as kind of the pan majority in the sense of still being rooted in traditions that emerged from that geography, right? So this like self-consciousness of holding back because you've just come out of this like bloody partition. Now you have East and West Pakistan at the time, right? Both of them founded as Muslim countries and millions of people displaced and killed during these partitions. So I think that attitude has carried over in along with that first generation diaspora. Because we didn't have that, we informally started like Bhagavad Gita reading groups and devotional groups where we would just discuss, because college is a time when you're asking these like really big existential identity-based questions.
Or at least you're supposed to be asking.
Or you're supposed to be. Yeah. Back in the day when we used to walk to school uphill, you know, like that's what it kind of feels like these days. But yeah, so we didn't have a formal structure. Fast forward to 1994, and there is a movement of Hindu student councils emerging on college campuses. And so the undergraduate students, a group of them, wanted to start this organization on campus. And basically a group of professors, and even then, even though the left-right disparity, I think it was still there in the 1990s. We weren't able to point it out. Maybe it wasn't as glaring. They came out and said, this is a Hindu nationalist endeavor. We don't want this on campus. And they tried to stop the students from having, like, creating a Hindu student council.
You continue, I need just some clarification questions. Mm-hmm. One, is it a Hindu nationalist endeavor? And two, if so, is that a good, bad thing?
Sure. You're asking me tough questions.
I just, honestly, because I want to learn.
Yeah.
I want to understand.
So there was a parent organization called the Vishwa Hindu Parishad of America. And they had a sister organization in India, the Vishwa Hindu Parishad, which does identify as Hindu nationalist. But when VHPA was created here, it was focused on building Hindu identity in America. So they had summer camps. I'm not super familiar. I wasn't involved with VHPA as a child or in my adult life. But they had that connection. So when they decided that, hey, we need to help create some sort of organization or structure for students to organize on campus, they did. So historically, was there a link with, and I wouldn't even, it's hard for me to say because I don't know all the inner workings of the VHP in India. But what I do know is that it was as much Hindu as it was Indian nationalism. But I would say that from what I have observed over the past 20 years, the way that nationalist is used in an Indian context is almost akin to like patriotism as opposed to some sort of like ethnic dominance. It's patriotism and at the same time acknowledging a civilizational identity that's rooted in all these different traditions having emerged from that area, and at the same time acknowledging that Abrahamic traditions have come sometimes through trade, sometimes by force. And now there are communities that represent those two, but we need to figure out how we live together, right? So regardless of all of that, you basically just had a group of students that wanted to have some sort of structure, some sort of organization, which would then open up like funding, right? Being able to have space. We used to just get together in one another's living rooms because we weren't a club. And there are benefits that you get when you are organized. And so I remember they reached out to me because I was a whopping first year law student, so of course could represent them. and so I still remember that afternoon we were in some office in the student union, the rights union, I think is where we were. And these professors started questioning like, well, why do they need to, you know, religion is a private thing. They just need to keep this private. They don't need to be out in the open and this and that. So I just asked one pointed question. I said, do you oppose the Muslim Student Association? Do you oppose the Baptist Student Union across the street? And they just kind of stopped in their tracks. I said, if you don't oppose them, if you don't believe that they need to keep their religion private, then why would you keep these Hindu students from organizing so that they have a platform?
Why do you think? Where did that opposition come from?
I think it comes from that like internalized self-consciousness that they left India, and it was, you know, they left India, many of them, in the 60s. So you're talking about a really young country.
So the opposition of, was professors?
They were Hindu.
Oh, I see. Okay.
They were Hindu.
Now it sounds very familiar.
They were Hindu professors. Only one or two of them. And there, even then, now that I think about it, they were self-censoring. Because there were some professors who came up to me afterwards and said, you make really good points. We agree with you. Why should you have to keep your religious identity or the ability to be able to discuss these questions or to organize on a, along a religious identity? Why should you not be able to do that? But, you know, so the, I was seeing what we are seeing today on steroids very early on. So when my co-founders, they too were having similar experiences. The last area that we were probably seeing this disconnect was in pop culture and in media, where we would read these headlines. And, you know, many of us were traveling back and forth to India, you know, over summer vacations and things like that. My husband lived in India for 2 years. And so you experience a country and then you read about it. And when it's completely, you know, you know, once you've been somewhere, I mean, I've been to Israel twice now with two different delegations. And when I read headlines, I know I have to like go further. Like you just know, because now you've seen it with your own eyes. So same thing with the Indian experience that many of us had traveled back to say, well, what they're saying, they're painting a picture as if there's no electricity in India or that everyone, you know, everyone is killing one another on some tribal background. And that's not the story of India. So all these things together, we had identified the problem. The question for us was, how are we going to solve it? And I think in our conversations with other Jewish organizations, it became clear that we needed to professionalize.
So you created an organization that's focused on education and advocacy.
Mm-hmm.
If you could send a message to every American out there, the average American, and most of them have never met a Hindu American in their life, like we've seen on TV, but just like with Jews, when you're a tiny minority, mm-hmm. people don't know you, but they think they do. If you could talk to the average American, what do they need to know about Hindu American community?
I mean, they're your neighbors. They might be working in your local hospital. They might be working in a convenience store. They are, on the whole, peaceful, law-abiding people who come with a very pluralistic worldview, because our tradition teaches us that the truth is one and the paths are many. So there's different ways of understanding or relating to one another, to a higher source, whatever it is. And so there's an openness about the Hindu community. There is a focus on family, on education. We're a wisdom tradition, and so it's kind of built into our DNA to focus on, whether it's secular education or religious education, we are encouraged to study, explore, question. The questioning part, I don't know necessarily that we have completely remembered that it's okay. I think being a minority, questioning can sometimes feel scary and threatening, like it did for my parents. I think we need to kind of rediscover that it's okay to ask questions. But that's who the Hindu American community is. They're living right there in your neighborhoods, in your communities, and just going about their day.
And what are the main concerns, the main issues facing the Hindu American community?
Well, I mean, on the whole, you know, misunderstanding is kind of an underlying issue. But I would say more recently, a lot of hate rhetoric. And my fear is that rhetoric very often correlates to on-ground action and violence. And we're keeping an eye out for that. But we're seeing a lot of anti-immigrant sentiment, and specifically anti-Indian sentiment around immigration, skill-based immigration, tropes of dual loyalty, this is going to sound familiar, stealing American jobs, all of these things we're seeing coming from the right, the far right. But what I think our challenge is as a community is to highlight the fact that a lot of those tropes were being weaponized by the left. By the far left, just a couple years ago. And even back then, we were lamenting that when you are seeing from the far end of the left tropes about dual loyalty, again, kind of suggesting that if you are Hindu American in the public space, you are somehow a Hindu nationalist. Or that you are an agent for the Indian government, because right now the current party in power is a Hindu party. And so you would see accusations against congressmen like Raja Krishnamurthy, who, if he was pictured with the Prime Minister Modi, you know, these far left activists are like, you know, who is he working for? He's a Hindu nationalist. He's a Hindu supremacist, et cetera, et cetera. I don't even know what supremacy means for a pluralistic tradition and a non-proselytizing one, but that's a different topic. But President Obama can give a bro hug to the prime minister and not be accused of the same things, right? So it's a double standard towards Hindus specifically. And so that dual loyalty trope, also the trope of somehow the immigrants who came here because it's skill-based immigration for the most part, that people of Indian origin and those who are Hindu have come here, they have achieved high levels of education and economic success. So now all of a sudden, somehow we are white adjacent and therefore not deserving of being in the tent requiring protection. Right. And so those types of tropes were already percolating because of the far left. Another trope would be that everyone who came here had some sort of caste privilege. So there were movements in California, for instance, to add caste as a category to non-discrimination law. Now, of course, as a Hindu, one of our core teachings is that every individual has divine essence, and therefore every individual, not just humans, but animals, plants, the world around us, all deserve dignity and mutual respect. And we should look at everyone with equal regard. So of course we're going to be against any sort of discrimination, whether it's a tribal, linguistic, socioeconomic, etc. But the way that the American laws have been created, we have protected classes that are based on facially neutral, generally applicable laws. So you can't say, take a category and say, oh, well, this category applies to these people, and therefore they get special protection, but we have to keep an eye out on these people because they're inherently oppressive. So what we saw was that oppressor-oppressed framework coming to life through policy. If California, and Governor Newsom vetoed the bill, even though it passed swimmingly because of the optics, is what I was told by several offices, where we said, this is a denial of equal protection. When you create a category that singles out and targets one ethnic group, that by its nature is discriminatory. And there are already categories like ancestry. Everyone has an ancestry. So if you are discriminating against someone on the basis of their background, it's already covered by California law without singling out one community. So these are the types of issues that we've been facing. Now, that was pushed by the left. Now we see the caste tropes. Now we see the stealing American jobs and all of that. And also, you know, belonging to a demon or devil worshiping religion coming up on the right. And no one in the middle is speaking out, which is a real problem.
Which is very much like what we're experiencing in the Jewish community, where the tropes of the extreme left are being used by the extreme right, and the tropes of the extreme right are being laundered to fit the needs of the extreme left. Mm-hmm. But I've noticed a never similar thing, that part of what you're doing in the Hindu American Foundation is your education is not just outward, mm-hmm. to non-Hindus, but also inward.
Yeah.
to Hindus. And I don't know if this is the same, but it feels to me like just like aspects of Jewish identity have been watered down to fit the American palate, right? That you actually see Jews identifying as white, whereas the category of Jew precedes the racial categories of white, black, mm-hmm. but they have watered down for Jewishness to accept and be accepted. And I've seen you talk about how the watering down of Hinduism to either monotheism or polytheism. Why is there a need to educate Hindus about what it means to be Hindu?
It's important because the colonial narratives about Hinduism are not just embedded in education in America. They're embedded in education in India. Now, that's not to say that there are not traditional schools still and lineages that are teaching, but they're teaching their particular tradition, their particular philosophy. But kind of like the big picture, like what does the Hindu tradition look like at the 30,000 foot view? That sort of education you really just get through school or public school education or secular education, maybe to some extent through pop culture or the media, et cetera. So one thing is actually just changing the language that we use, because when you use language that comes from a colonial Protestant lens, like if you refer to our iconography as idols, and now you're talking to someone from an Abrahamic tradition who views idols as false gods, you're already miscommunicating, right? So one thing is like, what is the language that we're using? The other thing is that very complex topics were reduced down to one word. And you can't, like a word like dharma. Dharma can mean a spiritual tradition. Dharma can be righteous duty. Dharma can be, and even in righteous duty, it can be your duty as an individual, your duty as a member of a society or a family. So there's just so many layers to some of these words. And the British, the earliest people who were studying the tradition translated dharma to religion or law. But can it mean those two things? Absolutely. But even the conception of religion is still coming from a very Protestant perspective. Like, oh, what is your single book? Who is your founder? When was it founded? Well, we can't answer any one of those three questions, right? So then does that relegate us to not being a religion? And if we're not a religion, then are we then denied all of the rights that are afforded on the basis of religion, right? So these are kind of some of these difficult questions that how do we talk about what this civilization is, what that ethos is, what are the things that keep all these diverse traditions within the Hindu umbrella, what ties them together, what are their differences, how do they get adapted in America. All of these are conversations that I don't really think that anyone has deliberately had or had in any sort of formalized way. And so when we put out videos like, how do we talk about ourselves? It's coming a little bit from a position of like, we're not going to apologize. We are who we are. And there's something beautiful about that. We don't need to conform. And we don't need to adopt language that isn't necessarily true to what our teachings and traditions are.
What's been the reaction within the Hindu community to your advocacy and education?
I think it's hard to say because there's not just one reaction. Some people, it's just too much, right? Like they're just trying to, do a good job in raising a family, putting food on the table, getting their kids ready for success, right? So all of these kind of, it almost seems like intellectual conversations, like, okay, how does it really affect me? So, you know, you have a lot of that where like, okay, I think you're doing good work. You know, we support you, all good, but really deeply engaging in those conversations, I don't necessarily think that that's happening. There are others who are confused because I use this as kind of a way to picture this. Like, imagine that you have a pair of glasses on that have like light green tint, but you have forgotten that you have those glasses on. And all of a sudden we're saying, hey, guess what? We're going to take your glasses off. And all of a sudden you're like, wait a minute, the way I've been seeing everything, I thought that yellow thing was some other color or whatever. There, it takes a moment to kind of adjust. And so a lot of people are in that position where you're like, okay, wow, I have my glasses, but now how am I supposed to see the world? All of a sudden you're introduced to all these different colors. What do these colors mean? Because up until now, they all had a green tint to them. So even getting ourselves to like rediscover what is it, what is our tradition, what do these concepts mean, how do we re-engage our stories from our own positionality, if that makes sense.
So one of the things, and this is where we kind of intersect, is you've been doing a lot of advocacy work, not just for American Hindus, but also against anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. In December 2023, which was very early on after the October 7 massacre, you wrote, "The scale of anti-Semitism and Hindu-phobia may be different, but the root cause is the same." Mm-hmm. So I want to ask you, what is that root cause, and how can the Jewish community work with the Hindu American community and be of help to fighting the same cause?
Yeah, the root cause is the same. I think you have people, you have kind of a radical left that is a coalition of social, I don't even know what word to put on it, whether they're Marxists or socialists. I
don't think they know.
I don't think they know either. I just think that they have divided the world into oppressors and oppressed, right? So you have that contingent. You also have Islamists who don't want Israel to exist. And there's, you know, theological bases for why they look down upon the Jewish people. The same can be said about Hindus. What we saw, so for instance, there was a clause in, I believe it was the constitution in India, where it gave Kashmir special status. It was Article 370. And this special status basically allowed it to remain kind of autonomous, even though it was an integral part of India. And over time, I don't want to go too deep into the history of it, but over time, basically, there was an Islamist insurgency, a separatist insurgency. And the indigenous Hindu population, Kashmiri Pandits, were cleansed from that area.
It should be noted that Kashmir is right on the border between India and Pakistan, which during the Great Migration, the Great Partition, you know, was kind of like left in the middle.
Right.
Right. Exactly. So a lot of millions of Hindus were forced to travel from Pakistan to India. Millions of Muslims were forced to travel from India to Pakistan.
Exactly. And China too. China complicates things there too. But because of this special status, actually a lot of the protective laws that were guaranteed to all Indian citizens, equal rights for men and women, you know, other social programs or empowerment programs for those people who had been historically marginalized, none of those applied to Kashmir. So in some sense, the abrogation of Article 370, which basically said, okay, Kashmir, you can't have a situation where the central government is responsible for protecting you and financing everything there, but then you are kind of absolved of following all of the other constitutional rights that every other Indian citizen has. So anyways, this article is abrogated, meaning they remove it from the Constitution with a parliamentary vote. And so you had a lot of activism happening here by professors on campuses, basically saying this was a Hindu nationalist move to oppress the Muslims in Kashmir. Never once would it be mentioned that Kashmiri Pandits or the Kashmiri Hindus had been cleansed from their, the religious animus behind the insurgency would never be talked about. Some of those same voices come to October 7th, you'll see them on the front lines as well. They're like not just from the same ideology, they're actually the same people. And therein lies kind of those commonalities. And they are joined then by this idea that you have one community that is the majority and they are oppressing this minority. But then they bring that to the United States, where both our communities are minorities. But then they'll still flip it in a way that, oh, well, they appropriate the language of minorities here, even though they're oppressing people there. And there's just no recognition of actual lived differences between what Jewish people contribute in this country, what Hindu people contribute here, what our political power, what any of our realities are here. They just get conflated to, you know, an ocean away.
So our communities not only need but must work together. But as we discussed before, there's just because we work together doesn't mean we agree on everything. And there's one point of contention that at least needs to be discussed. Mm-hmm. And that's the question of the swastika. Mm-hmm. So can you give the Hindu American version of like what's the perspective there on the use of the swastika?
Yeah. This has actually been a really robust issue of collaboration between the Hindu and Jewish community. You know, we've worked with organizations like the Anti-Defamation League, as well as Stand With Us, on this issue, because a number of states were passing legislation to define the swastika as a symbol of hate for not just Hindus, but Buddhists, Jains, and other traditions like Zoroastrians even. The swastika is a sacred symbol that is very much a part of our religious practice. When my son went through a thread ceremony, which happens at about the age of 9 or 13, they shaved his head and they drew a big swastika on the top of his head with a red vermilion paste. And I remember my husband's partner from work and his wife were there. They're Jewish. And her reaction initially when she saw this red swastika being drawn on my son's head by the priest, she's like, my heart dropped. And then she said, but then I continued watching the ceremony and how my father-in-law had to whisper something into my son's ear, and like just all the love and the celebration that surrounded it. She said it changed. She could see how all of a sudden her view towards the symbol changed. But that's just one description of how it's very much a part of our religious practice. If you go to a Hindu temple, when you see our iconography, you're going to see swastikas on it. If someone moves into a new home, it's very common practice to draw a swastika on your front porch. If you get a new car and you go into the temple to have a blessing ceremony done, they will draw a swastika on it. So when we see legislation that's trying to define it as a symbol of hate, that might directly impact our ability to freely practice our religion. So it took, first of all, we already had, luckily, a friendship based on some of these broader issues.
But before you get to the solution, I want to, like, but you also, you see the Jewish perspective.
100%.
Right, because when we see a swastika, like when you describe, like, painting a swastika inside your home when you move to a new home, A lot of Jews have experienced that, moving to a new home and someone painting a swastika
right.
outside
right.
on their cars. It's for many, many Jews, maybe even the majority of Jews, it's the ultimate symbol of
right.
being subjugated to hatred.
Right, right. No, and we're fully, fully cognizant yeah. of that. And that's where first study was necessary to see that what are the origins, like we know what Hitler's motivations were, but what are the origins? What was he trying to symbolize? What were the words that he used? And, there's been research done where he referred to it as a Hakenkreuz or a hooked cross, right? And at some point in time, it was translated as swastika. Now, I'm not an academic scholar to have, read every single resource that's out there, but we know that there's a distinction between the Nazi emblem and what Hindus are utilizing, right? So one is we need to know our history. Two is we have to be sensitive to both perspectives. And third is, well, then how do you find a solution? And I'd say that the solution has been inconsistent, meaning, and not in a bad way, but I think in a very human way. There have been places where, whoever was at the table, the Jewish voices and the Hindu voices, we've been able to find compromise to say, okay, we understand where you're coming from. Both parties are saying that. And we can agree that let's make a distinction between, let's educate the public on the sacred use of the swastika and maybe start changing our language towards the Nazi emblem and other symbols of hate, right? So there's been instances where that's been the compromise. There's other places where, our side is like, we don't want the word swastika to be continually misappropriated this way. But the Jewish partners will say, well, but our line in the sand is at least saying it's a Nazi swastika. And at that point, we're at an impasse because we don't want the word swastika to be used and they can't let it go for whatever reason. Sometimes,
interestingly, in Hebrew, the translation is hooked cross.
Right.
Tzlav keres.
Exactly. And it's interesting because I was at an event with the American Jewish Committee, and there was actually a survivor of the Holocaust that was part of this small group that I was talking to when this topic came up. And as I was just starting, and she said, well, in German, they don't call it a swastika, they call it a Hakenkreuz, which means hooked cross. And I said, yes, that's exactly what we're saying. So, but in those instances, what's been really powerful is that, okay, here's your line in the sand, here's our line in the sand. So on this one issue, that's okay. You advocate what you need to, we'll advocate what we need to. We both understand one another's perspectives, and this doesn't keep us from being able to work with each other on some other issue. So that's what I mean by inconsistent. In some places, we've been able to reach that compromise, in others not. What's most important is the conversation continues.
Right. I think that's the right approach, because we are different communities that mm-hmm. share similar values, which share similar problems, but we're also different communities. Mm-hmm. And if we don't have a conversation, at least one of the communities will err, if not both.
Right.
So we either need to find a way that whenever it's used in a religious manner, to be very, very cognizant of the hateful associations or mm-hmm. potential. And if it's used as a marking to say, like, hey, that's hate, we also need to remember, but it's also used for some as a religious
right.
symbol.
Right.
So, Haga, I'm going to end with the Here I Am lightning round.
Oh, boy.
A series of rapid-fire questions. There's no right or wrong answer.
All right.
The first thing that comes to mind.
Okay.
So, Haga Shukla, what is one thing people don't know about you?
I am a foodie.
What is one thing people don't know about Hindu Americans?
One thing that people don't know about Hindu Americans, that we are not We're very open-minded and pluralistic.
When was the last time you cried?
Yesterday.
What happened?
I think just I need to spend some time offline. You kind of have to keep it in perspective. You got to know that there's bots and whatever else, that they're not all real people, or they're somewhere sad and sitting in a basement. But at the same time, seeing all the vitriol, every once in a while it gets to me.
I agree. If you can be invited over for Shabbat dinner with any Jewish person in history, dead or living, who would that be?
Oh, I don't even know. And I'm forgetting her name. But she was a member of parliament. I met her in Israel. Oh, her name starts with E, and I'm forgetting what her
Inat
name.
Inat Wolf.
Yes.
Yes.
I would love to sit down with her again and just pick her brain, because she was so powerful.
What is your favorite holiday?
Navratri, that feminine divine holiday.
What is your least favorite holiday?
I don't think I have one. I don't have a least favorite.
When do you feel safest?
At home with my family.
When do you feel least safe?
In public spaces where I'm speaking, more so recently than before, just because of all the vitriol online.
What gives you hope?
America. America gives me hope. Just recently, there was an incident where a sitting city council member in Palm Bay City asked or demanded essentially online that Indians should be deported. And people came out to testify because there was a letter, there was a decision whether the council should send a letter to the governor to have him force him to step down because he was showing that he couldn't serve all his constituents. And there was a woman there, and she came up to the podium, and I was tracking like who's for, who's against in the public testimony. And she said, "I'm Christian, I own a gun, I believe in the Second Amendment," and I was about to like put, okay, this one is against our side. And she said, "And I think you need to step down, because the Indian and Hindu community here are the kindest people I know," and went on to tell a story about how this dentist in town, this woman happened to have been in an abusive relationship. And it was her Indian Hindu boss that encouraged her to, you know, that she would not be alone if she made the decision to leave, and paid for an Airbnb so that she could get back on her feet. And, you know, I could have very easily made assumptions. And I was so, so heartened to be disproven in that moment. So the American people and America.
Finally, every episode I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel, the Jewish diaspora, or the world in large. Where would you want people to donate to this week?
That's doing a Jewish charity? Any charity.
Any charity.
Any
charity. Have to do good in the world.
I think, obviously the Hindu American Foundation, but I think there's a Hindu charity called Seva, and they're doing tremendous charitable work around the world, serving people when they're in distress, regardless of their background, regardless of their economic or social circumstance. They are just there ready to serve and to help and to uplift and to ease their suffering.
How do you spell them?
S-E-W-A, International.
S-E-W-A. So Hag, where can people find you? Where can they find the Hindu American Foundation?
They can visit www.hinduamerican.org. We are active on all social media. I'm also active at Suhag A. Shukla. I'm the only Suhag Shukla in the world. So I'm easy to find, but I share a lot of thoughts on X.
And I'll tell people Suhag Shukla is S-U-H-A-G-S-H-U-K-L-A. Suhag, it's been a pleasure, and I'm looking forward for our communities to keep working together and do good in the world. Here I am with Suhag Shukla.
Likewise, thank you. And thank you for all that you do. We need these voices of moral clarity and moral courage.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at The Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."